Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak and I'm here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, push-ups, getting back to the basics with one of the age-old exercises, and now a push-up fundraiser. We'll speak first with Mike Lynch and Travis McGee of CrossFit Minerstown.
Good morning, Lynn. Then a conversation with Chris Nowinski. He's the author of Head Games and has shaped his career around the concussion public health crisis.
And finally, we'll speak at the end of the hour with Mountain Trails Foundation Executive Director Charlie Sturgis. He'll be talking about Mountain Madness. It's a whole month of a membership drive for Mountain Trails and an event that caps that off next Tuesday. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino. I'm excited to announce a new Intermountain InstaCare right here in Park City. We provide access to urgent care without having to leave the area. Instead of waiting in line, call us at 435-649-7705. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, push-ups are an age-old exercise and one that's regularly practiced down at CrossFit Minerstown. They'll hold a fundraising event on May 24th at 11 a.m. in which contestants will do as many push-ups as possible in 90 seconds. If it sounds like fun, you too should be there. Joining us to talk about this fundraising event for the Boot Campaign is Travis McGee, who's put this event together, along with Mike Lynch, who's the owner of CrossFit Minerstown. Good morning to both of you, and welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good morning.
Well, let's start with you, Travis. We've got this fundraising event coming up, and how exactly, I mean, am I going to get someone to sponsor me and pay? In my case, it would need to be like $10 a push-up, because I'm not going to do very many.
Yeah, so we tried to make it as simple as possible. So, you know, in connection with Military Appreciation Month, which is May, we tried to do something, and we always try to do something to give back to our veterans. So Push-Ups for Charity is a pretty novel concept that started a couple years ago. It's a nationwide event. This is actually the first annual event ever hosted in northern Utah. So it's a pretty big deal for us and for the state. We tried to keep it as simple as possible. So you can certainly have people sponsor you and pay per push-up. We just ask that anybody who comes and participates, it's just a minimum $20 donation. And my company, Futures Animal, we've sponsored the event. So we're going to provide food and beverages. We've got a couple vendors coming in that are going to have some great prizes and stuff to give away. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Certainly get your $20 worth in just all the extras that are going to be there. But more than anything, we just want to give 100% of everything that comes in back to the charity.
So, Travis, what's your connection? I mean, obviously, you've got the company that's sponsoring it, but I assume there's more of a connection to this event. And why did it take this long to get an event like this in northern Utah? Did it take you coming in and saying, we need to do
right.
it?
So the Boot Campaign is a fairly new charity to the veteran charitable organizations. They're only a couple years old. They're really starting to gain some steam and traction. Now, a lot of that coming from Marcus Luttrell, who many know from the movie Lone Survivor. He was the Navy SEAL who was a part of Operation Red Wing. And he's been a big supporter of the Boot Campaign. And I've known of them, being a veteran myself, for a couple of years, and my company, Futures Animal, has been a big supporter of that charity. And the reason being is, one, it's a very novel concept, what they created. So what they did is they had people donate money to the charity, and then they would give you a pair of combat boots in return. And people were pushed to wear those combat boots out in public. And naturally, anybody wearing combat boots in public is going to be stopped saying, hey, why are you wearing combat boots? And then it starts conversation, right, about the charity. And that really just took off. You had celebrities start wearing combat boots, and a lot of people really started supporting supporting the charity. So I wanted to bring that here with this push-ups event. It's not that it really hasn't been exposed to Northern Utah all that much. It's just that there's so many other charities that are out there right now that kind of overwhelm it, like Wounded Warrior Project, and they're all great charities. But the unique thing about Boot Campaign that I really find interesting is that it's a charity where the money that you give to that charity, they then do all the due diligence for you and find another charity that supports veterans to donate to on your behalf, so that you're not out there searching charities, struggling, saying, wow, is this really worth it? Where's the money going to? They do all that work for you. So their ratio is about 85%, 85 to 15. So 15% of any money given covers their overhead. 85% goes to the mission.
So the Boot Campaign itself, that's the name of the charity.
Right.
So Boot Campaign then amasses these funds and then finds just veterans organizations?
Just veteran charities, correct.
That's interesting. So it's kind of like a clearinghouse for veterans organizations.
Right, right. So they really try to leverage the celebrities that they have a part of it, Marcus Luttrell, and get people in there. And the whole reason for it is to give people that comfort level in knowing that their money's going to work. So they have a team of a staff that is constantly doing due diligence on charities and finding the appropriate ones for money.
Now, where do the boots come in? Or if we go do push-ups, do we get boots?
You would have to donate directly to the
right.
Boot Campaign,
okay.
And then you could get your boots through them.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there a fear that, I mean, this is off track a little bit, but I can see all these celebrities wearing these combat boots, which is a great idea, and having conversations, and then it becomes a fad. And then all of a sudden, people are wearing combat boots because Joe Schmo celebrity wore combat boots, not because they know anything about the Boot Campaign or that organization or veterans in general. Is that sort of a...
Well, I'm sure there's fears of that, but I think what they've seen so far is everybody who's become a part of it is very passionate about what they're doing. And I think they've done a good job, too, of the people they bring in really provide publicity to. They're making sure that they're genuinely involved with the charity.
How many push-ups can you do in 90 seconds?
I don't know. I at one point in time, it was 100, but that was a long time ago.
Here's a guy who knows how many he can do today.
Mike Lynch.
Not many. Yeah. Push-ups aren't my forte, but I'll definitely be participating in the event on May 24th for sure, and throw my hat in the ring and see what can happen.
Are there different categories?
Just male and male and female are the two categories. So top three male, top three female. And again, it really doesn't matter. I prefer people don't think of it as a competition as much. I'd rather have a lot of people come in and can only do two push-ups. And, you know, we're just giving money to a good cause.
Right. It's
so.
Just, yeah, $20 and you have a good time and try
time.
A few
right.
push-ups. But, you know, I really do have to ask the question, can I do girls push-ups if I come in?
Absolutely.
Okay.
What is a girls
Mike's,
push-up? Yeah,
right.
There's no such thing as a girls push-up.
It's a modified.
Thank you. Yeah,
it's
you
a scaled push-up.
Yeah, on your knees, that's fine. And even if that's challenging for you, we'll have another modification for it. So the whole point is to come in, have a good time, do as many push-ups as you can, hang out, talk to your friends, talk to your buddies, you know, have some food, have some beverages, and enjoy the community and a good cause for which we're gathering.
Okay. So again, that's May 24th. That's Saturday,
right?
At 11 a.m. Just show up at CrossFit Minerstown. You can show up right then with your $20 and
sure.
Say, I'm game. I want to do this.
Yeah, you can absolutely do that. And there's also online donations. You can sign up online and you can do that all through CrossFitMinerstown.com. Just
okay.
Go to the events tab and it's right there.
That sounds great. Well, CrossFit Minerstown has been doing a lot of community events, it seems like, things, you know, that you do right there at the gym, which is located right next to Holiday Village, Cinemark. What is it called these days? Cinemark.
Yeah, right.
And Sports Authority.
And Sports Authority. Right. So talk about a little bit about other things you've got going on at CrossFit Minerstown, Mike.
Yeah, so this summer is going to be jam-packed with both some additional offerings that we're doing through the gym as well as some community visibility. In kind of conjunction with May 24th, push-ups for charity. May 17th, which is this weekend, we're going to be doing Running with Ed and powered by Zion Bank. So it's going to be 10 of us, you know, townies out there running around in our gear. And there may be some interesting outfits, maybe by me, who knows, but others as well. But again, supporting a local Running with Ed. So yeah, we're excited about that. And then you'll see us on Tuesday nights out in City Park or at Quinn's Junction with our softball team. We had our first softball game last night. So, yeah, you know, we're doing a lot of things out in the community and, you know, trying to be as visible as possible and bringing people in the gym and kind of showing our take on fitness and our hue on fitness. And so, you know, June 2nd coming up, we're introducing a endurance class that – will be taking place Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, led by Travis, who you may not know, but very accomplished endurance runner, 100-mile plus. He has two big races coming up, the Speed Goat in July, which is ascending and descending two peaks, and then back again. So really four peaks.
Wow.
And then the Wasatch Front, which is a 100-mile race. So, yeah, Travis, you'll be in good hands with Travis for sure. And then we're also going to complement that through CrossFit Minerstown with specific in-gym workouts to complement what he's doing outside the gym. And it's going to be some interesting takes. You're going to be running with your body weight and you're going to be running with a backpack with some loading as well. So we're going to make it interesting and fun, and it'll definitely be unique.
Okay, so kind of embracing what your participants
sure.
do outside the gym,
right.
Which that makes it kind of nice because, as we know, many people here in Park City do a variety of sports and may not want to go into the gym.
Sure, right, and that's kind of the focal point there is, you know, our summer months are so short. I mean, we have 12 weeks really of you know, kind of prime summer, and people want to get out and ride their mountain bike, and that's going to be part of it. We'll do some mountain bike rides. So getting out and taking advantage of where we live, getting on the trails that are made for us.
Travis, as an endurance athlete, how does CrossFit complement your endurance training? I mean, they're very different.
Yeah, it's been unbelievable for me. I was certainly in my running career very keen on only running and running a lot, and kind of neglected the rest of my body. And it was actually my wife who was a member of CrossFit Minerstown before me, pushed me into it and said, hey, I think this is going to be good to get you in complete fitness. And after I was actually injured last year in my last run of the season, and it's done wonders for bringing me back. So I'm certainly a believer, and it's enhanced my ability tenfold. So right. It's been phenomenal.
Very interesting. I did a pilot program, too, on myself. It's very anecdotal, but I think it serves as great proof. One winter, I did CrossFit, and I did Nordic ski racing at the same time. Had incredible results. The next winter, which was last winter, I didn't do it at all. And all I was tired and sore.
Yep.
Because all I did was Nordic ski. So it really does. And Mike, wanted to ask you, you know, I know that a lot of people think CrossFit sounds pretty intimidating.
Sure.
They've heard the stories. They think you have to be a big animal to do it. But I've been in that gym enough to know that it's not all a bunch of mega, you know, athletes in there. It's normal folks, too.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we get people from all walks of life. We have kind of a wide array of age groups. We have, you know, young 20s into people into their 70s, replaced hips, replaced knees. Folks who've had replaced knees or replaced hips, hey, you're never going to run again. You're never going to squat again. They come into CrossFit Minerstown. They're doing both. Hey, this is the best I've felt ever. Now their good hip isn't feeling quite as good as their repaired hip, right? So so it's a pretty unique place. Yeah, I mean, if you're looking to bulk up in CrossFit, that's not the ticket. You know what, as well as anybody, that you come into the doors and you see some of the people working out, and CrossFit in itself and functional fitness in itself supports long, lean muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So you're not gonna gain 40 pounds of muscle unless, of course, you're training 4 to 5 hours and consuming 5 to 6,000 calories, which 99% of the people are not doing.
Is there a philosophy of your gym, Mike? I mean, seems like different CrossFit organizations or gyms, specific gyms, have different philosophies. Is there one that you can point to at CrossFit Minerstown?
Yeah, so the uniqueness of CrossFit is that we are all affiliates. We are not franchises, so think of franchises obviously with Starbucks, right? You go to San Francisco versus San Diego and you order a Americano, it's going to taste the same. So very different than the affiliate approach that CrossFit allows their affiliates to kind of run the gym how they want. So we have no outside influence from CrossFit.com. If you go to a CrossFit gym, you're going to see common stuff. You're going to see barbells. You're going to see bumpers. You're going to see rowers, black mat flooring. So it's going to look the same. So our hue on fitness is very different than a CrossFit, you know, that's in Southern California, that's, you know, a couple hundred meters away from us. We've been doing it for 2 years. We focus more on training than testing, right? So there's a difference there, right? So if you're testing constantly under the pressure of a clock, you got to go faster, you got to go faster, you lose range of motion, you lose the ability to feel what your body's doing, right? So we break it down and we train. So,
but are you training for something? I mean, are you training athletes or are you training just for fitness?
Yeah, good question. Good question. So it's general physical preparedness is what CrossFit kind of promotes. We do, however, we have a couple clients who are using CrossFit as a means to compete. So that's going to look very different competing within functional fitness versus coming in and doing a group CrossFit class. So CrossFit group class is targeted towards the generality of sport. And then we have the ability, or we have some one-on-one clients as well, where we're specifically programming for them.
Okay.
In their pursuits.
Great. Well, Mike Lynch, CrossFit Minerstown, thanks for coming in today. And Travis McGee, thanks.
Thank you.
Best of luck to you with your endurance runs. And remember, everyone, May 24th at 11 a.m. at CrossFit Minerstown, just near Fresh Market, right around the corner by Sports Authority. And it's a great cause. $20 gets you in, and you can even do 5 push-ups.
Whatever you want.
That's very great.
All right. Thanks, you two. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Chris Nowinski. He's the author of the book Head Games. It was made into a documentary. You may have seen it last year when it came to town. And it's all about what we know and what we don't know about concussion. We'll be right back.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Support for KPCW comes from the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation with year-round youth sport programs at Utah Olympic Park, including multi-sport, fly freestyle, Park City Nordic Ski Club, and G-Force bobsled and skeleton. Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities. Details at UtahOlympicLegacy.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, the more we know about concussion, the more we realize we don't know and haven't known over decades. But thanks to the relentless efforts of many, and specifically our next guest, concussion has been exposed as a public health crisis. It faces us all, but mostly here in Park City, our youth who are involved in many sports that leave them vulnerable to concussion. Chris Nowinski is the author of the book Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis. Nowinski was a Harvard football player who went into worldwide wrestling entertainment, WWE, right? And he began to question concussion and its long-lasting effects after his own injury. His book, Head Games, was made into a documentary. It aired locally about a year ago. He's joining us by phone to talk about what he's learned since then and what the current questions are and answers regarding concussion. Chris Nowinski, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
It's wonderful to have you. We saw your movie about a year ago here locally. It was brought to town, I believe, by Think Head First, which is a local organization, doctors that's all they do is concussion. We have that much of it in this community, you know, head of this base for the U.S. ski team and the many winter sports that we do here. So it is a huge question. And maybe we'll just start with a little bit of your background. We know you played football and went into wrestling, and then you had an injury, and that's when you started to ask questions.
Yeah, I'd never been diagnosed with a concussion in my first 18 years of contact sports, which included 8 years of soccer and 8 years of football, and then wrestling. And it wasn't until I had a blackout experience in the ring in a wrestling match that I forgot the rest of what we were doing out there that I had the experience. When I got backstage, I was kind of together, but I had a headache that just wouldn't go away. And for the first time, you know, like days later, that headache was still there. That fogginess was still there. And so I unfortunately didn't understand what was wrong with me. And so I lied about the injury. I didn't bring it up. And after 5 weeks of continuing to bang my head and exercise, I had to stop when I developed sleepwalking. And I had done so much damage by that point that I had to hang it up, and it led to 5 years of post-concussion syndrome, which gave me a lot of time to reflect on what I was, you know, what had happened to me and what I could do about it.
So now, Chris, with everything that you have learned and all the research and all the scientists that you have surrounded yourself with, I'm wondering, is the recovery from concussion, you know, one of the most important things? Obviously, you didn't give yourself time for recovery. If you don't do that and you get even if you hit your head just a little bit, is that when the real trouble begins?
Well, that's what the theory points to. We don't have amazing research on humans to say if you rest your brain, you'll be fine. If you don't, you won't. But all the evidence we have using animal models and other ways to look at it teaches us that, you know, one concussion in isolation, probably not a big deal. But one concussion followed by continued stress on injured tissue or multiple concussions in a row, and you may start opening the door to some very serious problems, including long-term degeneration.
Mm.
Hey, Chris, something that strikes me about this whole thing is here you are, you go through your own personal experience, and you expose this issue. At least this is how it appears to me, and maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe this issue has been around and it just wasn't getting the notoriety. But whether it was you brought notoriety to it or whether you exposed it, it's kind of related. How can that happen? And it reminds me of Al Franken, you know, doing his whole political thing and saying, I'm a comedian. If I can understand this stuff and if I can bring these issues to light, it's not that tough. And here you are, an ex-football player, an ex-wrestler, an ex-soccer player, and you're going, I had this personal experience. Where has the medical community been on this issue, and why wasn't it exposed decades ago?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. We were thinking about it yesterday as we were doing a training for some football coaches, and I started showing them quotes from the 1937 American Football Coaches Association meetings, from the 1968 NCAA Safeguards Committee, where they're all saying, when you have concussions, you cannot put athletes back into the game. It's really dangerous. Even in 1905, if you look at the diary of the Harvard football coach, he talks about letting the team doctor give a speech before every season saying, guys, if you have somebody who hits their head and they don't remember what's happening out there, call timeout and have me immediately come onto the field. That was the rule in 1905. And every time I love to ask my audiences when I speak, was anyone ever told this or ever asked to call timeout because you thought someone had a concussion? And the answer is no. So the funny thing is, there were a lot of people who, this was actually probably well known 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and we kind of forgot about it. And luckily there was enough research when I was hurt in 2006, enough people had been doing work on this, that I could actually just put their research together and just be a loud voice who wouldn't back down. I mean, that was kind of the argument we, you know, had to use in New York. You know, we're closer to the New York Times to spread this, but we just said, look, I'm just a guy, and I can the evidence is black and white. Like, why are we lying about this? Why aren't we telling people about this?
And are you surprised by that? Are you surprised that just a guy was able to compile information and then be tenacious about not backing down and expose this issue to the degree that it has, you know, become a frontline issue?
Yeah, I guess at the beginning, yes, I was surprised. I mean, I even remember one of my football coaches telling me, hey, Chris, there, you know, early in the game, he's like, aren't there doctors who look at this stuff? And if there was a problem, wouldn't they be saying so?
Well, that's where I'm coming from.
I don't think so. Yeah. No, that's what you think. But actually, if you know, I've done other research looking at other kind of public health issues and where they came from. And it's kind of funny that, this, you know, people just kind of, you know, you can be blinded by the status quo and never really dig into things. You might need to have a personal experience to understand it. One of the interesting ones is if you look at smoking and lung cancer, the first person to ever make that connection and really start making a stink about it was a graduate student. It wasn't even a medical doctor yet, who looked at a series of autopsies and said, hey, oh, the smokers are getting this lung cancer, the non-smokers are not. What gives? End up writing a book about it. He was one of the guys that really brought awareness to that. So it sometimes just takes somebody, you know, because it's not easy work. You know, there was a lot of fights over the years. So sometimes you just have to want to go through the uncomfortable conversations because you believe in it so much and you can break through.
That's right. Well, sorry, during the scope of the movie, and I didn't read your book, but I did see the movie, it seems as though the gravity of concussion and the seriousness of the situation was for a long time sort of shrouded and kept cloaked by the NFL. But during the time that you started uncovering this, there was a little bit of a shift. Talk about that shift and why you think it was kept so secret, really, in the beginning.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to kind of look at this from a financial perspective. You know, once money became such a big part of sports, there were a couple issues. One, you know, if you could have players play through concussion, your team might be more successful. And also, you didn't want to pay for the long-term damage that you were doing to people. And so, as a policy, if you could minimize the effects of concussions, you'd probably want to. And that's what the NFL did, but they went dramatically too far by also publishing really bad research, trying to convince people that, you know, kids are safe too, and everybody's safe. Mm-hmm. So the shift really happened over many years. I mean, the first brain that I, you know, and a lot of it was came from the studying the brains of athletes when they passed away. I mean, that was really kind of the difference maker, because concussions are largely an invisible injury. And so it's been hard to make a case that concussions are so bad, because almost everybody who gets them seems fine days, weeks, months later. And so what's the big deal? And you don't get their life track to appreciate what happened 30, 40 years later. But by studying the brains post-mortem, starting with Andre Waters and now 200 athletes later, we can show the very devastating pictures of what this disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, looks like. And it just basically became a game of one brain, they blew it off. Two brains, they blew it off. Three brains, now the media is getting involved. Four brains, now there's something going on. 10 brains, and suddenly, you know, Congress is involved. And so it really became a game of increasing the evidence and increasing the pressure through the media to force change that we knew needed to happen.
Can you define chronic brain encephalopathy? Is it just the effects, the long-term effects or the permanent effects of concussion?
No, chronic traumatic encephalopathy is actually a degenerative brain disease that all the evidence point to is caused by trauma. So it's the idea that some level of hit, so it's either a hard hit or we think maybe multiple hits in a short period of time, can spark a degenerative process in a tiny part of your brain that will continue to spread for the rest of your life in an Alzheimer's-type pathway. And eventually, once it takes enough tissue, once it's killed enough cells, you start to have symptoms. And once it's, you know, and beyond that, you can eventually get dementia from the disease.
And Chris, the 200 brains that you've looked at and taken your data from, I mean, initially you might assume that they were all from one or two sports and primarily football, but this is contact sport is a much broader umbrella. Can you kind of walk us through the various sports and the level of risk that people are being exposed to in those different sports?
Sure. You know, the initial research was done in boxing. You know, that's why we called it punch drunk. Football came next, but in between football, which was the first case was published in 2005, there were other brains that were studied around the world. And it wasn't even just athletes. By 2007, there was a soccer player in the literature, someone who had epilepsy and had 100 falls from seizures where they were hit their head, two people with developmental disabilities who engaged in headbanging behavior, a circus clown who shot out of a cannon too much, and a victim of abuse. And since then, now we've added football at every level, college, high school, pro. You know, we're 58 out of 62 professional football players that we've studied have had the disease. Ice hockey, just recently, in the last few months, we added soccer, rugby, baseball. I mean, basically, wherever you're exposed to a lot of concussions, we're going to find it if we get those brains to look at.
So let's talk about what goes on at Boston University. It's my understanding that that's where they first started looking at brains at post-mortem brains and discovering literally by taking cross sections of a brain and looking. Is that where the bigger part of the research is still going on?
That's the kind of one of our core research programs. So the way it started is my treating physician, who happened to be one of the world's experts on this, Dr. Robert Cantu, and I started the Sports Legacy Institute in 2007 when we started getting some brains. And then we went to try to find top researchers to work with to study those brains, and that was Boston University. So we partnered together along with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, because we actually have the brain bank at a VA center. And it started with the brain bank work, because that really told, the ultimate goal of all this is obviously to understand risk factors for it so we can prevent it and understand how to treat it. But that we needed to start with a common resource, because there was no center in the world dedicated to CTE research before we started one in 2008. So we needed to just build that brain bank to start understanding what the disease was that we were facing so we could identify ways to diagnose it in living people and to eventually treat it.
Okay.
And so now we have a clinical research program. We have 100 NFL players that we follow longitudinally. We have a phone registry where we get information on 800 people annually. We have a basic sciences program where we've learned how to create CTE in a mouse model using blast injury. So it's a really growing group of experts that are getting their arms wrapped around this.
I want to ask you a few questions. I'll just throw these questions at you, and you can let me know if there are any solid answers there's any scientific evidence that says one way or another that whether certain heads are more susceptible to concussion, whether you ever fully recover from concussion, and once you have had concussion, if you remain more vulnerable to the next concussion.
Sure. In terms of if you're, certain people are more at risk, empirically, yes, but we don't really know why. We pretty much know that every disease or injury has risk factors to it, and many of them are genetic, many are environmental. But there hasn't been enough work to really tease that out. What were the other two questions?
That's right. I'm just testing you to see, what your post-concussion syndrome is. And then once you get a concussion, are you able to ever fully recover?
Functionally, yes. So it's the idea that most people with one concussion will get back to themselves, but not everybody does. We don't really know what percentage that is. It's somewhere between, 1 and maybe 10 that have long-term changes. Everybody who has concussion, we often talk about it as, if your brain's a computer, we talk about it as a software issue. Your brain's rebooting. But the more we know, basically everybody suffers some sort of physical brain injury, and that's not going to necessarily heal itself. So your brain probably changes and for the negative, but it most people on tests will turn out to be just the same. But long term, something's different.
So what they've seen with the postmortem brains is that once you even get one slight concussion, there remains some sort of lesion or something on the brain, right?
Right. We do see white matter injury in just about everybody who we've got in the brain within a couple days or a couple weeks of a concussion. So you do have diffuse axonal injury. It's very, very small. It's microscopic. It's hard to find, and you can't see it on scans. So that's why we assume people are fine.
Okay. And then the third question was whether or not once you get a concussion, you're more susceptible. You know, you just get a light head knock and you've got another concussion.
Again, the evidence is yes, you do get more susceptible. It's not great evidence. Epidemiological evidence is, you know, some studies say you're 2 to 4 times more likely to have more concussions. But part of that also is the fact that you now understand what a concussion is, so you're more likely to report future concussions once you've been diagnosed with one, because most people ignore them when they get them. But there's also, you know, when I was training these coaches, in fact, of the four high schools that we had, two of their head coaches were both post-concussed still to this day. One said, every time I get tapped in the head, and they're both players through college, one said, every time I get tapped in the head, I get a concussion, and the other one said he still has headaches from the concussions he had in college.
Wow.
And these guys were, you know, not young. So, there's definitely something to that.
So, Chris, now that you've started the center in 2008 and you've been compiling this data, it seems like an awful lot of progress has been made in making this a public issue and bringing awareness over that short period of time. But I guess my question is, are we still at the tip of the iceberg of this issue, or have we drilled down to, you know, some sort of depth of understanding? Or do you think over the next 10 years, we're just going to be totally shocked by what we learn by the additional information that you're gathering?
I think we're at the tip of the iceberg on research. I mean, you know, the more we dig, the more we're just seeing, you know, shocking things. I mean, the study came out yesterday. And I forget the university, but it was 25 college players who were concussed in the last year, 25 college football players who didn't have concussions, and then 25 normal people. And the hippocampus of the players who were concussed was like 20% smaller than normal people, which is just like a shocking finding. I mean, 20% is huge. So, you know, I think we're uncovering more and more concerning things about brain injury and their long-term consequences. In terms of how safe our kids are, you know, we're dramatically safer now. If you think about it, we have 50 state laws that say you can no longer put a kid back into the game when they have a concussion. And in most states, we're training coaches, and in some states, we're training athletes. But the reality is we have so much farther we can go to make athletes safer that, you know, still wouldn't even change the games. And then we do need to have some serious discussions about changing the games. If you're talking about, age differences are huge. So we're talking about getting rid of heading in soccer before you're in high school, tackle football being maybe a bad idea before you're in high school. And then, you know, you look at what you guys are dealing with in terms of winter sports and action sports, you have to be plain to say what we're seeing in like snowboarding and the tricks that people are doing. You know, we're getting to insane places where none of these kids are going to, you know, you really worry about the long-term consequences from all these falls.
Well, Chris, I wanted to ask you, you sort of segued into it. I was going to ask you to project out maybe 20 years from now with additional data and research and what we're learning, and we're at the tip of the iceberg, and the change that could conceivably occur to the game or various contact sport games. It seems like football could theoretically go away because, you know, you can't play football without banging your head every now and then. And I know you're talking about protecting kids and it's much safer for kids, but it raises the question in my mind, you know, if we're just not having contact football while you're a child, what makes it okay to do when you're not a child, when you're an adolescent, or when you're a young person, or when you're a professional? I mean, why does it all of a sudden go from super dangerous for our children to okay now? I mean, that...
Yeah, well, I mean, you're getting into more, you know, cultural questions than medical questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you can see it from a lot of different angles. Like, part of the reason we say it's more dangerous to, you know, play football as a child are things like, you know, there's data saying if you have an athletic trainer, you're more likely to have your concussions diagnosed, and we don't provide them for anyone before high school. So you'll never diagnose a child's concussion. Your chances are just much, much, much smaller. The whole idea of hitting a child in the head before they're even old enough to recognize when they might be concussed and then can report it to you, we assume that might start in the teenage years, but we're not sure. So on the one side, you can easily say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be encouraging kids to get hit in the head hundreds of thousands of times in any sport. Like, what's the point? Just change the sport. And on the other side, you have the people who say, well, there's risk in everything. And what, you know, can we control that risk? And so, it's more of an ethical – it depends on what your ethics are and what you know about brain trauma.
Well, you've hit on it. It's that cultural change, and we have these, you know, cultural phenomenons where we think it's okay – to be a boxer, you know, and the first one you used was that punch drunk. Well, I mean, you could make a pretty strong argument that, you know, nobody should be boxing, but yet fighting occurs and is going to continue, and we've made it a sport and it's part of the culture. But it brings me back to the mothers of kids when I was growing up, you know, and football was a big thing and nobody worried or talked about concussion and a lot of other things that shock me now. But you know, there was always that kid who wasn't allowed to play football by his mom. And wow, it's like there's the beginning of that cultural shift. And what you're doing with your medical research is bringing awareness, and you've pushed that shift. I mean, it is shifting. There is something happening here, and it's a cultural phenomenon. And I think it's great that you're doing it. But do you see that going so far that we actually are not allowing certain sports to take place?
You know, I think from a policy perspective, it's very unlikely that anybody has the ability to ban any sport. So it'll basically come down to a lot of individual choices. Those moms. And part of our role is to provide every parent with the best evidence that we have so they can understand the risks of the sport they choose to engage their child in.
Well, I'll tell you, from a personal example, again, my son played lacrosse, which is a contact sport, football, contact sport. I would not let that happen now. And that was 8 years ago. So that's a big shift in a short period of time from an ex-football player.
Yeah.
In high school.
Right, right. Well, we've learned a lot more. I mean, you can't ignore these brains and the horror stuff. I mean, we're just talking about the science of it, but talk to their families about the horror stories of being raised by a man with chronic traumatic encephalopathy who has impulse control problems, aggressiveness issues, memory problems. I mean, it's rough.
Chris, may I ask you if you have kids?
I do not. I did just get married in November. Somebody was willing to accept the risks in my future. I'll have to deal with that soon, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay. So when you do deal with that, will you let your kids play contact sports?
So the way I look at it right now is, I can't imagine enrolling my child in a sport, at least certainly prior to high school, where brain trauma is not accidental and rare. Right, kids will collide, I get that, and that's fine, but the idea of repetition is not a good idea. I think hopefully the science will be better to know about what to do once they start getting to physical maturity and what the real risks are. But, you know, I played basketball this morning, and I still play three times a week. I mean, that might be the sport I'm trying to steer my kids into.
Right. Okay. Well, let us know where we can find what you're doing currently and where all of this research is going.
So I would recommend going to the website of our nonprofit. So that's the Sports Legacy Institute. There you can grab, information. You can learn about, if you're a parent, go to our concussion checklist site. There's links from there where you can assess how safe your child's program is and learn ways to make it safer. You can pick up a copy of the book. You can pick up a copy of the documentary. This is something where parents really need to engage the material and make some hard decisions because, you know, their kids only have one brain and you got to protect it the best you can.
That's right. Well, Chris Nowinski is the author of Head Games. It was made into a documentary. Many of us around here saw that last year, and it is fascinating and engaging, and we're very happy that you could join us today. So thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye. Again, Chris Nowinski, author of Head Games. We'll be right back with Charlie Sturgis. You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with Tim Henney. Joining us in the studio now is the Executive Director of the Mountain Trails Foundation. It's Charlie Sturgis, and he's joining us to talk about the first membership month ever in the 21-year history of Mountain Trails Foundation. He's going to tell us about why you should be a member and how membership is distinguished from donation, right?
That's the way it's going to be.
Hi, Charlie.
Good morning.
Well, Charlie, let me ask you a quick question on this. Mountain Trails has been around for 20 years. Does really well, has done amazing things in the community. We have that the organization has members. Why, for the first time in the organization's 20 years, are we doing a membership focused drive?
Well, one reason would be is the number of nonprofits in the Park City area is almost like 80 nonprofits. So we are actually competing with other people's needs as well. And there's only so many probably dollars that are going to be donated in this community at any given time. So trying to maybe make sure that you aren't sitting on your laurels and not worrying about it, you know, that's not usually the best strategy. So we don't want to be out there aggressively raising money, because I'm not sure that's exactly what we need to do. But we do need to keep our membership base, our voice intact and loud. And we do want to keep moving forward and be around the next 10, 15, 20 years to support non-motorized recreation, human-powered sports, and the sort of healthy lifestyle that we all do know and love in this community.
So is money – I mean, where does money fall into this? Because obviously membership drives entail money. It always does. As you just said, there's competition for the money amongst 80 organizations in town. But Mountain Trails does really well in that respect, always has, at least it seems, with Get Live PC, Give PC. You're the highest, you know, year in and year out, which is fabulous. So the support seems to be there. Why the membership? What does membership bring in ways that money doesn't necessarily bring? And I think you touched on some of that, a voice.
I think the voice is really the big part, especially in the state of Utah. Non-motorized human-powered sports are not the highest thing on the list when you look across the state, especially at the government level. Even if you look at the recent Senator Hatch issues about biking being sort of unimportant. We want that voice to be heard, and we always want to be able to express that voice on, and Mountain Trails wants to be that voice for this community and for other people who are willing to join. Not unlike, Trouts Unlimited, Ducks Unlimited. You want to have that environmental voice out there, and being a member, and especially as Lynn kind of queued up for us here, versus a donor, one of the things that's unique about, I think, Mountain Trails is we have a membership as low as $10. And the reason is we want every high school kid out there who maybe feels like he wants to be a part, that he can be. You go to IMBA, I think IMBA is low, I think it's $35 or $50, something like that. It's definitely higher. And we definitely saw an example of a few people during Live PC, Give PC, give like $8, right? Well, that was hard, mm-hmm. But it was meaningful to them. So we don't want to cut anybody off on the basis of the size of the donation, but we want their voice to be heard because they care about the human-powered, non-motorized recreational aspects.
Well, and that touches on another aspect of this, I think, because from looking at just from a money standpoint, if you could go out and raise your entire budget from one donor, you've accomplished the same thing that you accomplished by raising your entire budget from numerous sources, including hundreds, if not thousands, of members. So, why take the approach of trying to broaden your membership and get those $8 contributions from people that use the trails, that believe believe in the trails, that have a connection and an attachment to this public and community amenity. I mean, there must be some reason that we're not, that the organization isn't just out trying to capture one grant to take care of everything versus connecting with numerous individuals and citizens in the community.
How about because it takes a village to build it?
Yeah.
Okay, because one grant is maybe a windfall, and when you have the support of your community behind you, even if it's all, even if it's everyone puts in $10, that adds up, and that's sustainable, and that's sustainable into the future.
It's about ownership, really. I mean, if you put your $10 in, you have some bit of ownership on the trails. I mean, and it makes you feel like you're part of a bigger thing, right?
Absolutely. And that is, you know, I guess another way of expressing it is ownership. I mean, the people who are out there using the trails, I mean, certainly look at days like today. There's going to be hundreds and hundreds of people out there, and things are drying out. It's absolutely gorgeous out. You do feel local community pride. You can't help it. You're out there using, you're having fun. You're out there with your friends and family. It's great, and you do want to be part of that, and Mountain Trails offers that opportunity to be a part.
Are there people out there that think that trails should be provided for free, that they should just be paid for by tax dollars, or do they? Are there people that you're constantly educating that it's not actually paid for by tax dollars? I mean, in some part it is with grants, but...
I think, Lynn, the answer to the question is how we fund trail building here is maybe a little confusing, and the public is not as well informed as they could or should be. And that's our responsibility, I think, for Mountain Trails and probably even Park City Municipal and Basin Recreation. All of us maybe can do a little bit better job. But and that would be one of the reasons for the open house, is to be able to answer questions like that and take a look at, you know, what are maybe the funding mechanisms. Like, a lot of people don't realize that our races, our local races, are a significant fundraiser for us. And, you know, most people do races for to get some recognition, some name out there, but it's actually a significant financial issue for us, and it provides a lot of trail building funding, so it's a big deal.
That's right, and the more we attract people to this community to use our trails, the more trails we need, really, to keep it. So the conflicts, which might be a topic for another show, so the conflicts don't arise.
Yeah, we can't touch that one this morning.
We've just got about a minute left, so let's talk about May 20th. That's Tuesday from 5:30 to 9. Mountain Madness, it's at the Canyons. And what's happening?
Okay, so this is our first ever membership drive, and we've been at a few coffee shops as well this week. 5:30 to about 7:15 is going to be just Q&A kind of stuff. Come on, show up. We'll have some maps out of our projects. Steinville Basin, I believe, is going to be there. Basin Recreation is going to be there. Park City Municipal is going to be there talking about some stuff as well. And so you'll be able to basically chat, socialize, and Canyons is putting out a nacho bar, popcorn, that kind of stuff for the movies. We're going to have a drawing. Reynolds Wheels is a new sponsor for Mountain Trails. They'll be putting up a beautiful set of carbon wheels, your choice. You'll be able to get additional opportunity drawing tickets when you actually join up as a member there. So from anything from, you know, we're willing to take anything from $10 to $1 million. So, you know, $1 million and one we're not taking. But anyhow, I would say we'll be there, staff, board, to answer questions. Let us know what you're thinking. We'll be talking about the survey that we had out there, which 700 people responded to, which was tremendous. We had almost 400 write-ins. We definitely got a sense that there's a lot of people out there who really care, and we want to talk to them and go one-on-one if we can.
Okay, so find Mountain Trails at the various coffee shops, but Tuesday, May 20th, 5:30 p.m., it starts at Canyons Resort. Where is it?
It's right up by the gondola in their conference tent, and the movie is Rising from the Ashes, about the Rwandan cycling team that was put together after the genocide. It is a very heartwarming movie, and it is kid-appropriate.
Okay. Charlie Sturgis, thanks for joining us today. We want to also thank our Other guests, Travis McGee and Mike Lynch of CrossFit Minerstown and Chris Nowinski with Head Games. Thanks to our underwriters, Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and Park Meadows Country Club. It's time now for news. Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life.